The opinions expressed in this program do not necessarily reflect the official policy or position of DKI APCSS, the U.S. Department of War, or the U.S. government.
I always use this expression, cute, pink, and fluffy. Like, it's somewhere there, it's nice, but is it really a weapon? Is it really a tool? Do we really have to use it? Maybe we should put all the cards on military strategy. I was like, yeah, guys, but you still need law, especially that law becomes so vulnerable. And we not talk only about big countries or organizations like European Union, where my country is a member, Poland, right?
Aloha, and welcome to Dialogue, where conversations shape security. I'm James Minnick, Colonel United States Army retired and professor here at the Daniel K. Inouye Asia Pacific Center for Security Studies in Honolulu, Hawaii. This is episode 57, Lawfare, Weaponizing the Rules, a conversation with Dr. Joanna Sakura. For centuries, nations have competed not only through military force, but through diplomacy, economics, information and law, treaties, legal claims, international institutions, and competing interpretations of legitimacy have long been foundational tools of statecraft. In that sense, the use of law as an instrument of strategic competition is nothing new. What has changed is the environment in which that competition occurs. Today, legal arguments shape global narratives in real time. International institutions influence strategic freedom of action. Legal interpretations directly affect access to resources, maritime boundaries, economic relationships, and even the justification for use of force. Increasingly, geopolitical competition unfolds not just on land, at sea, in the air, and in cyberspace, but in courtrooms, international forums, in the arena of public opinion. This growing phenomena is often referred to as lawfare, the strategic and instrumental use of legal mechanisms to achieve political or military objectives. For some, lawfare represents a new front in irregular warfare. Others argue it is simply the latest evolution of an enduring reality that states have always used legal frameworks to advance national interests and constrain competitors. Regardless of where one falls in that debate, there is little question that law, legitimacy, and international norms have become a persistent battle space. Nowhere is this more evident than in the Indo-Pacific. Across the region, questions of sovereignty, maritime rights, freedom of navigation, and territorial boundaries are being shaped by legal arguments as much as by military capabilities. Competing interpretations of international law are no longer merely academic exercises. They are a primary mode of contestation over the regional order. As the global system evolves toward a more competitive, multipolar environment, understanding how law intersects with power is vital for policymakers, military leaders, and security practitioners alike. The strategic question is no longer whether law influences competition. It clearly does. The question is how states deploy it, how adversaries exploit it, and how allies and partners can navigate this increasingly important dimension of the security environment. To help us explore these issues, I'm joined today by Dr. Joanna Sakura, an internationally recognized expert on international law, lawfare, and the Indo-Pacific security. And she's the editor of the forthcoming volume, Lawfare in the Indo-Pacific. Joanna Sakura, welcome to Dialogue.
Thank you very much. I am honored to be here. I still recall our previous conversation exactly 1 year ago.
It was a year ago. And unfortunately, that time I had you on a small screen and was looking at you. I get to see you in person. In fact, I've had the opportunity to work with you over the last month, at least. I think you've been here at the center.
We had, yes. Not only I provided my article to your book, now you wrote a chapter to my upcoming book, and now I am adjunct professor at the center.
We have benefited by having you as an adjunct here.
Thank you.
You're here for the course, the Comprehensive Security Security Cooperation course that's going on right now. And It's a 5-week course and they're well into it. In fact, I'll lecture this week. I've got a lecture for North Korea's military modernization is going on. I should probably think on that before that time.
Looking forward to your speech.
Oh my goodness.
Yes.
And then your seminar leading here too, right?
I am a leader of Seminar 9, call sign 9mm.
I saw that phrase be used several times. The classes are fun, dynamic. The fellows here, there's a lot here too. There's a
From so many countries, different mindset, military, police officer, humanitarian workers, governmental advisors. I am learning a lot from them.
That is the beauty of the courses we have here, is we bring in such a diverse group
Yes.
of people with different experiences and from many locations. And you can take this learning and you can engage with it in your own experiences, and it becomes rich for those who really need it.
Everyone,
So
including me,
everyone. Yeah.
definitely, definitely.
I've been here for 10 years. There's not a engagement that goes by that I don't personally gain from. I really
Right.
enjoy it. Oh, thanks for being here, Joanna.
My pleasure.
We're going to
Thank you.
talk. You're one of your very favorite subjects, I think.
It is. When you invited me, like my heart started to, run faster because this is my personal and professional mission. We must talk about legal warfare. I think we don't do enough in this regard. I think Americans are probably the best ones, researchers, academics, but you talk about that from American perspective. What I bring to the table is international perspective because when we want to address our adversaries, we must understand their mindset, their legal mindset, why they do what they do, why they manipulate international law, what they want to achieve, but also what we want to achieve through lawfare.
Well, which is exactly why you're the right person to sit and have this discussion. And so let's pull on this. Let's talk about law as a battle space. And so, I mean, law, like diplomacy, economics, information, I mean, these have all become tools of strategic competition in many regards, yeah? So let me ask you this question. How should we understand lawfare as part of a modern battle space?
First of all, to accept that it's part of battle
Ooh.
space. So many people disagree.
I would wholly agree with you. We kind of hold that off as if though, and as a result of that, perhaps we're less proficient in
Correct. We
this
are
debate that
missing
we
the
could.
point because Russia and China, they know how to manipulate lawfare. They do that officially at every possible level, and we somehow miss that. We're like, no, law is, I always use this expression, cute, pink, and fluffy. Like, it's somewhere there, it's nice, but is it really a weapon? Is it really a tool? Do we really have to use it? Maybe we should put all the cards on military strategy. I was like, yeah, guys, but you still need law, especially that law becomes so vulnerable. And we not talk only about big countries or organizations like European Union, where my country is a member, Poland, right? But we talk about small island countries, delta countries, Asia Pacific countries, and they all look at big countries, how they manipulate international law, what do they do with it? So lawfare obviously comes from legal warfare, lawfare. So how law domain became part of warfare to gain military or strategic advance. But I will always add that what you greatly pointed out, that there is nothing new in legal warfare, but what is new now are the values. That those are democratic countries. We are based on freedom of speech, of navigation, human rights, transparency of public administration versus totalitarian regimes who will not stop themselves until they are stopped, unfortunately. So they are using, misusing, malinterpret international law, and that's where we should address lawfare at the current battlefield.
So say more about that, about this, the things that are new about lawfare today. You talk about values. Clearly, is the rapidity at which this is going on, the integration with all these other domains of war. I think of the information warfare and that with legal warfare really accelerates the justification the trying to justify what is being done. But say more way on this.
First of all, we have, I would say, miserable United Nations. I believe in the Charter of United Nations, but unfortunately, this organization has been used against its own values. And China and Russia, they both have mastered lawfare. They use institutions, they use international tribunals. They agree with some articles they want to, but they have no problem with saying no to tribunals which were trying to put them back to order. The most famous would be International Criminal Court, where Russia simply withdrew when they were told to get out of Ukraine. Russia said, no, we are not in the court anymore. You cannot say anything to us because we are already outside of this international organization. And China, permanent court of arbitration versus Philippines.
2016, right?
Exactly. China said, no, we don't believe with the justification of the court, therefore that we will not follow. And that has never happened in history, that countries would actually openly fight against the institutions they had themselves established.
Yeah, no, I agree. Things, the environment seems to be up. People seem to be performing differently, or countries seem to be performing differently in the environment and it feels as if I did a lecture here recently. It was on the system in disorder, and it feels like it is disordering in many regards. You give examples and highlight some of that right here. I mentioned a little bit in my opening, but about these competing views of lawfare, right? I mean,
Yes.
so not everyone agrees what
Correct.
lawfare is or who uses it. So where do you fall on this spectrum? And does intent matter in defining lawfare?
Definitely. As you know, there are two lawyers, there will be three legal opinions.
Exactly right.
So, do you really want to know the answer? We are missing the fact that legal warfare is there. We are wasting so much time on definition, what lawfare is. I've been working, as you know, for NATO for the past 5 years. Just now I finished the lecture for our fellows about NATO strategy for Indo-Pacific. And even the alliance changed. Now anymore we cannot use lawfare, we can use legal operations.
I think you
Seriously?
use that in, I saw that in your paper. This different, yeah.
I think it's a waste of time. It's just like juggling of the words. Because again, legal operations, I think it's different connotation than lawfare. It's broader term, institutional, instrumentalized, psychological, also social media. Lawfare is happening on social media, on TikTok, Instagram, using fancy words. Trying to justify that according to Article ABCD, that country did that to protect their rights. But this is far from the truth. And you see, even my voice, I'm getting angry right now. I'm
Well,
getting angry because we should not be so pessimistic about that tool. Law can be used as a tool. And whenever, especially in Europe, I think Europeans are much more sensitive than Americans. And whenever I say that there is weaponization of law, people don't like it. It's like, Joanna, don't say that. It's like, but this is not me who is weaponizing the law. It's already been used that way by Russia, China, but also North Korea, formerly Venezuela and Iran, against us and our values. Because again, this battle, it's all about our values, our freedoms, what kind of world we live in. Do we protect what we all agree, so rule-based order, or no, there is no order. Then we have the power of, or the law of power, strength, aggression.
I want to pull you further then. So you've brought up about Russia and Ukraine. Russia has justified its actions in Ukraine, and it's used has done this through legal and historical claims, right? And so How has Moscow integrated legal narratives into its broader strategy during this war? I mean, talk to us a little bit about this. I mean, I could pull more on this, but go ahead.
Definitely. And again, what I will say, it's not directed towards us, NATO, European Union, America, because we all know that sovereign referenda, they were all failed. That, like, that was nothing democratic about those referendums in Eastern Ukraine to justify presumable help to Russian citizens, under Ukrainian regime. That is all lie.
So who are they talking to?
Exactly, their allies, countries who are depending on them economically, politically. Don't believe me? Look at United Nations General Assembly voting. Most countries were either hold the Russian side or at least abstain. So yellow color will be there. So those are the targets of Russian and Chinese manipulation of international law. We would say, oh, this is stupid. Of course, no, nobody believes that this is lawfare. Okay, but we are not the target. They want to keep their allies tight. They do still have a lot of countries, developing countries, Africa, South Asia, most of Oceania countries, South America. They are dependent economically, military, officially, unofficially. And it's all about the law, the agreements they signed, the companies, the infrastructure projects. My students always ask me, like, yeah, but what's the problem when to Bolivia, Chinese company get in, they build a tunnel? It's good for the company, right? It's like, no, guys, because they bring their labor law, so there is no right for the worker. It can bleed out and nobody will give insurance or whatever. They bring their environmental law, so they destroy the environment, they poison. And again, this is what the countries sign in. This is lawfare in a true form. This is dangerous because they get inside local politicians, local government at the various layers of the government, and they put their people.
How's this happening in this part of the world here in China and the Indo-Pacific? I mean, China is increasingly using legal arrangements, arguments,
Yes.
domestic legislation,
Yes.
maritime activities, and they're doing this to advance their own interests in the region, right? And so, how is Beijing using lawfare to shape the Indo-Pacific in its maritime domain? You spoke
In
some of the.
so many ways that we could probably, James, talk here for next 3 hours.
This is
That
the
would
strength of
be.
yours, this area right here, right? It is.
It is. Do you remember, ladies and gents, Umbrella Revolution in Hong Kong, 2019-20? People were tired of China, Beijing trying to narrow down their autonomy. When British left, they were promised autonomy, relative autonomy.
Yeah.
But Beijing's like, no, we don't like the word autonomy, freedom, right? So people came on the streets, marching, protesting with umbrellas. And again, what happened? Beijing did not use tanks or military strength. They used law. Over the night, they changed the law, totally limiting autonomy. So every political opponent, strike, protests, they will accused of treason against Beijing. Easy, cheap, one night done.
How about in the maritime domain?
Maritime domain. The way they interpret South China Sea, this is against UNCLOS they signed, and they like to poke at US that US never signed, but well, you follow the law. They did sign, and they never follow the order. What was really nice, and again, lawfare can be also positive. Here, I want to emphasize that what Philippines, that was the Philippines' idea, that Philippines brought this case to the court, so they would have it white, right back on white, that this, what we are protecting, it is according UNCLOS. Those are our exclusive economic zones. So they were given legal justification. Yes, Philippines, you are right. This is not internal Chinese Sea. Absolutely not. But
And
again,
often, isn't it then, because you earlier you were talking about these smaller powers,
yes.
And so Philippines up against China is clearly a smaller power. And so when you ask about what tools are at our disposal to be able to
Yes.
try to advance our strategic interests, I'm listening to you, and you said they chose to go before the law to try to use that tool to try to secure their national interests, right?
They did. And the same Ukraine against Russia. They also went to International Criminal Court in The Hague in the Netherlands asking for the warrant arrest against Vladimir Putin. But again, Russia was not anymore in the court. Again, the law tactics that the smaller countries, the victims of the wars, of war criminals, as we should call them, they seek out help at international institutions. The problem in international law is weak. It does not have sanction or executive powers. So how to protect? We don't have international maritime police. How can we stop Chinese overfishing tuna, which is the main source of protein? We have a few fellows from Oceania countries. They've seen that. I sailed across the Pacific on my
You did about 2 years ago, wasn't it?
Exactly, correct. That was more, 2.5 months open sea. And I witnessed, James, only Chinese vessels. Months on the sea,
No
open
place.
sea, and only Chinese. And whenever I was asking Captain, sir, can you give me some data about the vessels? And he was like, something is missing or something is wrong with either leasing or age or something about the vessel. And I was like, okay, I will double check, go to maritime professor of biology, maybe those are fishermen, maybe. And she told me, no, there is nothing to fish here.
Listening to you, so many thoughts. Let me share a couple of them. So, in 2015, I was the Secretary of the Military Armistice Commission in Korea. And in that year, the Chinese had gone into the Han River Estuary, which is inner waters between North and South Korea. I have no doubt that they probably, I suspect they probably engaged with the North beforehand, but they were exploiting an area that had not been tested previously in its fishing. And so while there are approvals that can be done, they went in there to extract as much resources as they could before they were challenged to do it. We ended up actually sending, we did challenge them, and diplomatically they took no action. But combined operations that moved some force against them in the Han River Estuary, and they had 10 vessels in there. These, fish, Chinese fishing vessels are large.
Yes.
And
Yeah, exactly.
yeah, but
Exactly.
anyhow,
Shadow
we
fleet. Oh my
yeah
goodness.
we so we had boarded two of those and those vessels and taken them, Koreans did, into custody, and the rest had moved. But they continued to secure that area afterwards because of this encroachment in areas testing what they could do and should not do. And so listening to you made me think of some of my own experiences a few years back in this area here. When you're talking about the use of language and things, my mind went to thinking about this is really semantic maneuverings, and it is. I said in my monologue about how this, we've seen this stuff before. A lot of this is not new, and when I think about semantic maneuverings and some of the history, I go back to the Cuban Missile Crisis. And that was nothing if not a test and reframing of the legal categories to be able to advance what you wanted to do. And so couldn't did knew that the word of quarantine would be more preferable to blockade, which was clearly a legal an act of war. And so this was, how do we use the law to come up with a way to do what we needed to do? And so then they selectively were going to quarantine, missiles coming into the area. They would But we see this a lot, this semantic maneuvering, using the law to
lot
try.
more, I would say. It's coming more and more and more, different levels, regional organizations, global organizations. You mentioned your beloved Korea, your expert in it. I always laugh, and again, this is my dark humor. Just look at North Korea. They are not in the World Trade Organization, and then they can produce and sell whatever weapons they want. They are not, inside the organization. And of course, this is not the way to go. But they knew. Why would they be in the World Trade Organization? But also, what China was, and you mentioned Taiwan, that strategically they were pushing away Taiwan from every major international organization or UN body, like World Health Assembly, like international organization, aviation, civil aviation organization. They have their own air fight, right? So everything what they've been doing for decades, and as we all know, China is thinking strategically in advance, decades to go. Not I would say like us, the we Westerners, we react after something is done. Unfortunately, war in Ukraine woke everyone that oh wow, suddenly we don't have peace anymore. We thought that after Second World War everyone would love each other. It's like no, it's not the case because some countries, they have their mindset, like Russia, Balshaya Russia, big Russia, and China, Da Zhonghe, so big China. So in their mindset, the politicians, and again, we are definitely not anti-China or anti-Russia. We are against the regime, the deadliest communist regime, who are oppressing their own citizens, who are killing political opponents, torturing, misusing. So it's not that they are using those tactics against us, but primarily they start from own citizens. And this, according to United Nations Charter, it puts on our shoulders obligation to help, because those people, they are not to be blamed for the fact that they were born in those countries. They have the same unique human rights, human dignity, and what we should watch, what is happening there? No, definitely not.
Pull you on gray zone, and I mean states increasingly. I mean they pursue these strategic objectives below the threshold of war, right?
Yes.
Armed conflicts, and this is what we refer to as gray zone. And so, why is lawfare especially effective in the gray zone? Why do you think so?
It is because it all depends on interpretation. We should not and cannot afford waiting for a new treaty to come. Suddenly, we will have in UNCLOS a new interpretation of shrinking islands, or we will come up with some anti-terrorism treaty. Absolutely not. Those are tackled at the level of national law, not international. We are living in such a divided world that I don't believe that countries suddenly will sit down and sign a resolution. I don't believe so. I think we are so much divided now. So if we don't have hard law to point at least we can change interpretation. Because what terrorists, like pirates, they are doing, they act at the threshold, so not touching the definition of war crime or national criminal acts. They do everything around it because they feel safe. Because we, how can we chase them? How can we accuse them? How can we collect evidence, do all the forensics, if actually there was no legal statement, no legal criminal proceeding to start with? I think it's brilliant, it's genius.
Sometimes I wonder gray zone activities whether they're avoiding conflict, operating below it so
Yes.
that they don't go into conflict, or they're pressing an advantage before conflict. You could argue, to your earlier examples with Russia and Ukraine, that a lot of the actions taken that were in fact done that way, that they were seeking an advantage in advance of what became conflict.
It can up with war or armed conflict, but also not
Well, of
necessarily.
course, not necessarily.
This is the thing that the lawfare is very much useful at both full-scale invasions, though some don't like this term, or recently I heard about Eastern Flank, that actually why Europeans call it Eastern Flank, it should be Eastern Front, and flanks should be elsewhere. I don't know, your army, you can tell me more about that. But definitely, the more we focus on semantics, as you said, the words, I think we're just wasting time, because China has lawfare in its official doctrine.
They do.
They have it.
Yeah, that's in their three warfares. You want to say more?
Exactly. Ladies and gents, in 90s, two army colonels, they came up with this idea. That again, Sun Tzu, the art of war, how to fight, how to win without fighting. And here we have law, we have international legal instruments. They themselves have been also building with us. But also, we have psychological warfare and social media. So, TikTok, even like we are building a new generation of people. And again, what kind of values they grow onto. When China, and we all know that the internet is so much limited to educate new generation, for patriots, for someone who would think that Western world is not the best way, we are the best because Chinese Communist Party is providing the good values. But in our hemisphere, we see so many accounts which are administered by China, by Russia. I myself, before Polish elections, was accused of working for Russia, which was ridiculous because I was defending Polish right to defend the border. But because Russia did not like that, because they were already using instrumentalized migration against Poland, against NATO and European Union, trying to force illegal migrants through the border with Belarus. So I was the head of the campaign. To say that not only Poles have the right, but we have also the duty under the Constitution. So a lot of accounts, a lot of bots, however you want to call it. Again, lawfare is already there. I am wondering why it's not at our side, why we are not using internet, social media to promote our values, where we stand for. It's cheap, it's efficient. We're not there yet.
Yeah, no, I thought similarly that we are the law ought to be a domain,
Yes.
just like air, land, sea,
Correct.
cyberspace,
Correct.
because it is happening there. And since it is, we would be better trained and better prepared and positioned to be able to engage in it, opposed to reacting all the time. No, I wholly agree. And then, just finishing up your last thought on the three warfare doctrine, you're talking about public opinion warfare, psychological warfare, and then legal warfare, and how it's being effectively
It
used.
is.
Yeah. Earlier in the conversation, we were talking a little bit about information, and so how closely connected is lawfare with disinformation and the battle for legitimacy? What are your thoughts?
It is. It is highly connected because I myself have seen, especially in Europe, even adverts, when you listen to, YouTube, you can see more or less some kind of narrative. Like the war in Iran recently, and from again European side, you will not see the argument why US is supporting Israel and its stance against the terrorist organization being Hamas and Hezbollah, for years being founded by the deadly regime of Islamic Republic of Iran. You will not hear that narrative. What you will see crying children in Palestine. This is information, this is psychological operation. And there will be always some kind of justification that, yeah, we have convention on the protection of human rights, children rights during the war. It's like, yeah, but why you don't address that about terrorist organization? You will not find those arguments. And not packed as people would like it. So in a funny way, with some memes, whatever, I think we're missing our chance to sell our ideas, to protect our values in the way we should. Because when we look at NATO and all the psychological operation NATO is doing, and just a month ago from here, so online, I was given a lecture about lawfare and strategic operations. That we are missing out. We are not using this opportunity how we should, that we should be bolder in stating that if we will not protect our free world, it will be gone. Freedom is not granted forever. We must fight for it, we must protect it, but also to educate future generations why we have to do that. And I think that education, when we talk about legal warfare, is important. I myself teach in Poland courses for officers, generals, and lawfare is there. I'm very happy. But I think that some people might not see connections as we are talking how legal warfare impacts strategic mindset or strategic operations in NATO. At the highest level, why are we doing this? Why do I need to know law? I'm a soldier. Why do I need this? I have my rules of engagement. I know what I can do, more or less. This is it. Like, absolutely not.
Would it be fair to say then if lawfare provides the justification, then legal warfare, is provides the amplification, and together you're able to be much more, effective in this space.
I agree so. I agree so. And again, it depends from where you come from. We have our fellows from the Philippines. For them, lawfare is real. They witness that every day what a Chinese Coast Guard or maritime militia are doing against their fishermen every day. This is breaching, misusing, malinterpreting of the International Permanent Tribunal. This is the ruling everyone should accept because they signed the treaty, but they're not. So this is pure lawfare.
So then, how do we prepare democracies for this? I mean, as we said, many democracies, they still view law primarily as a framework for restraint to keep bad
Yes.
things from happening. But if lawfare is now a persistent feature of strategic competition, and it is, I mean, what must democratic nations do differently?
First of all, education, but everything comes from the top. So, how about our politicians? How about our flag officers? I mentioned that Ukraine was pursuing this International Criminal Court warrant arrest against Vladimir Putin, and that was exactly on 2022, March 16. That failed because Russia is not in the court. But what happened the day after, on the March 17th, Xi Jinping went to Moscow to meet Vladimir Putin, knowing already that, well, attempt of International Criminal Court was just ridiculous. Unfortunately, that was not good way of using international law. But those two head of states, they said from now on, Russia and China will guide and guard international law obedience. They said that. So they openly mentioned that now Russia and China will make sure that international law is interpreted as it should be. So obviously for their own benefits. And I'm asking, where is our response? Where are we? Why our heads of states, including Secretary General of NATO, would not say we are here to protect the norms. We are here to make sure that international law is there for everyone and it applies equally. How about starting from such statements?
We got a lot of audience questions, and so let's go through a few of those. And we're grateful for the audience that submitted more questions than we're going to go through, but we'll ask a few.
Definitely.
So this first one's asking, kind of about this beyond defense. So if countering adversary lawfare is not enough, we kind of talked about that, what proactive legal and diplomatic tools should the United States and its allies employ?
First of all, promote. promote. You have the most amount of lawyers doing legal warfare for most of European countries. And again, I'm publishing next book, and there are not so many European authors. So America can really develop legal warfare and promote it again as a shield to protect our values. So we stopped associate lawfare as something negative that only China and Russia are doing. We are equipped with legal instruments, institutions, bodies, UN agencies to protect ourselves. We pay annual budget to UN and other institutions, tribunals, courts, but I don't see effects. So how about countering lawfare from what already we have, so institutions, organizations? Educating is what we already mentioned. And I think this approach, this mindset that we will accept there is not only dime analysis of military conflicts or conflicts between the states, but also there is legal element.
Yeah, I think those instruments of national power, when it's expanded out to dime fill, I think the L is legal as well.
Some people edit.
Yes, you're right. Some do, but it's not nearly dime is the
Yes,
construct that is being
it is.
used. No, you're
It
absolutely right. It's probably people like you who go to the dime fill and add in the legal
Well, it's
aspect.
like spraying, illegally.
This next question is asking about small states, and you spoke a little bit about this, but maybe you might pull a little bit more. And so, how can smaller states leverage international law to protect their sovereignty?
They can. And actually, here, ladies and gents, I will address you to check our last podcast because we were exactly talking about the power as united region of Oceania, small Pacific Island states can do because they are waiting and waiting for United Nations to take some action. There is no action. So what they decide to do? To gather their data, maritime boundaries, and to deposit to United Nations whatever happens to their baselines, if they will be fixed, ambulatory, if they will get more sand and have more territory, or maybe submerging less territory, they will still keep the legal rights of their territory, and territory is one of the components of a state. So therefore, they will secure statehood. And this is pure legal of warfare because China is manipulating, they are using the vulnerabilities of those countries. Again, Oceania, check the podcast with it.
I actually listened to it, our podcast from last year. I listened to it this weekend as I was preparing, and I enjoyed it. It was good then, it's good now. So I concur with you. Enforcement and legitimacy. So, how much confidence should states place in the enforcement of international laws when several major powers are not even parties to institutions such as the International Criminal Court, which you mentioned earlier?
Go full in. Just, I know that people love all the, legal movies when there is some drama between lawyers that they fight, they use argument. They are always confident. I'm sure you all like that because of the level of confidence. Here is the charter. Here's the article I'm using. This is the truth. This is the ultimate truth. So we have United Nations Charter, Article One, the main reason why countries currently 193 are in United Nations because they all believe in peaceful resolution of conflicts. Full stop. So why don't we go back to old school and use the strategic legal thinking for our own benefit? Because when we become weak, when we become less confident in what we believe, then totalitarian regimes, they step in. They have no problem with misinterpreting those rights, with manipulating international law. And this is detrimental for their own citizens, as we spoke, but also affecting other countries who are somehow, they are not with us, they're not with against us, but they might lean towards totalitarian regimes. So in our own benefit, we must be there before they are.
You know, as you're talking about that, I thought of whether it's in criminal law, civil law, international law, often procedural saturation is a tool of stronger powers, right? They can just bury you in the system because they've got the resources to do that. And it becomes a difficult thing. And you see it in all those different types of law applications, don't you?
Definitely, just look at my old continent. A lot of legal struggles between countries versus countries, European Union versus countries versus European Union. And you just do. You have to prove your legal rights. You have to prove your benefits. And yes, it does take years, but I think it's worth it because we should start thinking strategically with decades to come, just like Chinese do. We cannot be only there when something happened.
Yeah, and then of course you mentioned an example of the Philippines in 2016
Yes.
and how they were successful despite
Exactly.
the
Exactly.
challenges. Yeah. This next question is asking about neutrality under pressure. And so, can international legal institutions remain neutral and credible when states increasingly use legal narratives as tools of geopolitical competition?
They should because they are. They are there because countries decide to, because countries, when they created this intergovernmental organization, being, for example, UN, they gave some competences to those organs, believing that they will pursue their competences on their own behalf. So it's not about malinterpretation or any crazy other irrelevant interpretation, but just the pure expressis verbis what countries agreed to. So when it comes to neutrality, again, myself, I don't believe in neutrality. I believe that sooner or later countries would have to pick the side. Are they with freedom-loving nations or against? Because how can you say that what China is doing is wrong, but then still rely on it economically? So you support the regime if you do that. The same formally with Venezuela and Iran. So therefore, I think it's hypocritic if we condemn some regime, but we still keep close connection to it. But again, international organizations are there to keep the stability, peace. However, those beautiful terms has been, misused recently. We still have our obligations. We believe in international rules-based order. This is what differs us from other regimes.
Joanna, I've known you for years. You can see the black and white in law very clearly. This question is going to ask about the gray. So,
Oh.
and so, I mean, written law often leaves room for interpretations. It is
Yes.
clearly intended to do so. It's not by accident, I would
Yeah.
even argue. And so, in international law is exactly that way because people don't want to get, countries don't want to get hemmed in too much.
True.
But so then the question is asking, how can democracies reduce the legal ambiguity that adversaries then exploit in that gray area of law?
What I observe is it's good that we don't think like our strategic opponents, definitely, but why can we learn from them to understand that if they are using gray zones, we will still expect them to play black and white? If they are using TikTok for their own needs, why we still would address diplomatic note on official website? You know what I mean? This irregular concept is, I think, played by only one side. And where is our irregularity? How to address the perpetrators, the enemies, the opponents, however you want to call them, with addressing the tactics exactly where they come from, not our thinking and again, I'm not absolutely calling to break the law, absolutely not. But ladies and gentlemen, the example from Ukrainian front, where Ukrainians, they followed Geneva Conventions and they marked the shelters, right? That here are children, dzieci, So don't bomb those places. What Russians did, of course, they bombed it because for them that was direct target. The same with humanitarian protocol. According to Geneva Convention, you have to mark the line of the humanitarian convoy. You have to notify in advance, so all the parties would respect that. So Ukrainians did, they followed the law. What Russians did, they mined the road. So what I'm saying, I'm not saying that they should not follow the law, but maybe think that Russians, they also have good lawyers. They also read the treaties. They signed those treaties. So they will definitely use that knowledge against them. So how about notifying minutes before going a humanitarian right? Or like changing something on the map, where is the shelter with civilian? You know what I mean? If they are manipulating the law, why we still expect them to follow the law?
This kind of goes to your earlier point about how we can be more trained in understanding how to employ
Correct.
the law to our own advantages and stuff. So, yeah.
Correct.
This question is now asking about lawfare and strategic communications. We've kind of talked a little bit about this, but I mean, as states become more sophisticated in the use of lawfare, should strategic communications be integrated into the broader legal and policy efforts? You spoke a little bit towards that, so maybe just be thoughtful, clear on this. What do you think?
Definitely, and I got actually the same question for a NATO strategic communication course last month when I was teaching. And yes, I believe so. I think we should educate in our current legal frameworks what we do, why we do this, why we have to protect our free world, that all the freedom of speech, which we are having now, this freedom that we can talk about, that we might disagree to some things, right? But the fact that we are able to articulate this, not everyone on this globe has this ability to do so. So we must protect that. We were given this right, but also duty to fight for it, to protect that. And again, I think that usually soldiers or other branches, that when they are given task, they don't have it at the back of their mind that actually they do this because of law, of law their country stand for. They are part of the treaty, alliance, NATO, or other regional cooperation or alliance. And it's an example of NATO Plus that now Japan, Republic of Korea, Australia, New Zealand, they became best friends of NATO. Who would have thought? Washington Treaty never said that there will be countries from outside of the region, and not mentioning Indo-Pacific. But because of the values, because of the same interpretation of freedom, those countries far away from the other side of the globe, they come to NATO summit. They are invited as honorary guests because of the fact that we share the same legal culture with them. And more importantly, China and Russia, they contradict what we believe so.
Joanne, it's been a wonderful hour together.
Already.
Oh my goodness. And so at the close, I like to put forward recommendations on books and stuff. And so I actually want to recommend your book. You're actually it's two volumes, right? I
Yes.
mean, there's a lot of substance to this lawfare in the Indo-Pacific book, two books that you're putting forward with Springer. When's it coming out? And say more about it, and more about this topic if you'd like.
I am honored. Also, as I mentioned, there will be your great chapter on lawfare, that actually lawfare is not that new thing.
Law is a battlefield, nothing, and get this ethical part.
Exactly, exactly. I was invited by Springle. They wrote to me that, well, ma'am, not so many people deal with lawfare. Would you like to write the book? I was like, yes, can I gather my people? Definitely. And so I did. But then, like, well, you provided so many chapters. So either we cut something, it's like, absolutely not, or you will have two volumes. And so I am very proud because there is no other book like this, Lawfare in Indo-Pacific. There are two books in American market about Lofer, but then again, it's American interpretation. And I want my people to have, just like you have, international view, international awareness, what's happening, why it's happening, and why it is all connected. What is happening in Taiwan affects Ukraine and for so I'm really proud of this. We are now picking the cover. So I really hope that very soon we will have hard copies.
Oh, this is wonderful. And this actually comes on the heels of another book you previously did. What was the title of that one?
Exactly. International law and security in Indo-Pacific, strategic design for the region. So again, my great authors, including our dean.
Which
Wait,
old?
exactly. He wrote a fantastic foreword to the book that we don't only analyze current events, but we are trying to shape strategic design for the future because future is now.
It is. Thank you for taking this hour. Oh my goodness. I'll remember this for a long time. I
Me
very much
too.
appreciate
It's my pleasure. It's my passion. I hope this podcast will reach the most amount of people to make a change. Thank you for that.
As we conclude today's dialogue, this conversation reminds us that power is exercised not only through military force, but also through ideas, institutions, and law. Understanding how legal frameworks shape strategic competition is essential for allies and partners seeking to safeguard their interests, protect their sovereignty, and navigate in increasingly contested security environments. These conversations shape security. On behalf of all of us at the Daniel K. Inouye Asia Pacific Center for Security Studies, thank you for joining us for this important dialogue. My thanks go to Dr. Joanna Sakura for her insights. I'm James Minnick. Until we meet again, aloha. The opinions expressed in this program do not necessarily reflect the official policy or position of DKI APCSS, the U.S. Department of War, or the U.S. government.